I want to begin by saying, if I can just find my notes, thank you to Barry for last week's sermon. I took copious notes. We had discussed previously at another meeting to cover the subject of finances, and as a good accountant, he gave excellent advice on how to look at finances and the framework of which we should live our lives by. This is going to be the second one in this row. I'm going to take a completely different tack, you may be pleased to hear, because you don't want to hear all that again, because you already have it. And if you studied your notes as I did last week, and having had quite a few years of experience in Pasadena with the college there and financial aid and so forth, I think I've seen the yin and the yang of people who want to have their way and have their cake as well. That oftentimes doesn't happen. So today I want to address some basic concepts on what I would call an economic system. Specifically, I want to persuade you to obey the economic values, laws, and principles of God. Now, I'm going to go through four areas for you. Area number one is, what is money? Area number two is to give you three examples of historic mismanagement of money. Thirdly, we'll look at a couple of biblical principles which apply. And then finally, we'll talk about attitude. Okay, so that's where I'm going. And the title of the sermon is Fundamentals of Economic Systems, numero dos, number two. Because the economics of how we live and what we do and how we budget and behave and so forth was given last week. So let me begin with the first one. What is money? Would anyone like to pose an answer to what is money? No? Aha. That means either you don't know, or you're being stubborn, or you don't want to answer, or you're ashamed, or you're embarrassed, or you're broke. Which? Does anyone know what money is?
It's a means of being able to trade goods.
That's very good. Means of being able to trade goods. All right. Can we define it a little bit more than that? Can we maybe think about some means that we might use to trade goods with? Accepted means. Ah, it's a little bit more specific, because I was hinting at bartering because I knew that David has chickens. It's something that is generally accepted by a group of people, however large that may be, as a medium of exchange. And it is also a specific measure of value or a means of payment. So that's what money is. Historically, money has been many things. It has been, in the Solomon Islands, large pieces of rocks with holes cut in the middle and carved out, and they're very expensive. In one case, there was one that they were transporting from one island to another that fell in the water in the bay, and nobody worried, because everybody knew it wasn't going anywhere, and they all knew where it was, and there was the value sitting in the water in the bay, and it was valid, and it had value and acceptance, and it was a means of exchange. It can be nails. It can be bullets, it can be food, it can be any number of anything that a group of people agree that there is a certain value and a means whereby we can fairly exchange. city state where he regulated weights, measures, money, value, and so forth. So that's why I go back to Hammurabi. It shows you that every organized society from the beginning of history has to have these things in place to function well. Let's go to Moses. Moses, and if you'll turn to Exodus 21, please, you'll see the beginnings of the Mosaic Code here. It wasn't Moses' code, that's the name it's given. Of course, it was a code given by the Lord or Yahweh. And just look at the headings, we're not going to read them. The law concerning servants. Now, these are the judgments. That's the value that God has placed, if you will. It's a determination on how you treat a servant. Verse 12, the law concerning violence. And if you want to know what happens in the Code of Hammurabi, you can Google Hammurabi and go back and actually see what specific penalties were for people who were in the upper class and people who were servants. There were different penalties you would pay in each. So we have the law of violence. Then we have in verse 28 animal controls. And if an ox gores a man or a woman to death, then the ox will be put to death. Okay, and then we go down to chapter 22, the responsibility for property and so forth. And verse 16 of chapter 22, the moral and ceremonial principles. And then the little bit I love, because chapter 23 has a title, Justice for All. And it says simply here, you shall not circulate a false report. Do not put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. You shall not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice. You shall not show partiality to the poor man in his dispute. So when you have disagreement about matters, they are to be done justly and fairly with witnesses, and not just take up a cause without the right information and so forth, with unrighteous witnesses and all that. And then we have the laws of the Sabbath and then the annual feasts. Well, these give us an idea as to some of the needs of stability in any society. And societies need organisation and standards set for two reasons. Number one is, I hinted at it, we need to have values and we need to have stability in a society. And the second thing we need to have is not only stability but certitude. We need to be certain these things will take place. Okay, let's go to historic example number two. And by the way, if anyone would like me to email the background on this, I have typed it up and got it on a file, so if you'd like to read further on it, just let me know. Historic example number two. Before I go there, you will find a great deal of commonality between what Hammurabi gave as laws and what Moses or the Lord gave as laws. Not because he copied, but because all societies need similar rules and laws. Okay, historic example number two. I'm going to take you back now to the 6th century BC, to the great Greek Empire. And an individual named Solon, S-O-L-O-N. Why is Solon important? He is a remarkable man, that's why. He was chosen to be the chief magistrate at the time of great economic distress and social unrest. Are we seeing this in Greece today, in Italy today, in France today, in London today, in New York today, in Pasadena, California today, in Los Angeles today, and we could go on around the world in many places. Society was in upheaval and a great deal of rest. He was asked to save the state. How did he do this? He had to address the problems. What were the problems? The problems were severe harshness in debt laws. In other words, that if you went into debt, severe, very, very severe penalties and high interest rates were applied to you, and you, your land could be taken away, your inherited land. Remember what Scripture says about inherited land. And you could be put into a slave category and not get out of that until you pay the debt. Well, if you're in a slave category and your land is taken care away from you, how can you work your way out of debt? You can't. So you put a permanently low class of people. And it got so onerous that the people were rebelling. So what happened was that he addressed the practices of both the impoverished and the rich. And the practices of the rich on the poor were really angering the society as a whole, and uprising and insurrection were threatened. So Solon had been chosen to do this. Why was Solon chosen to do this? Number one, he was a wealthy man, and number two, he was honest and didn't treat the poor or those who were with him badly. He was not part of the onerous treatment. So Solon was erected or put in the place of being the chief magistrate of Greece at that time. He was acceptable to both the rich and to the poor. So Solon did what? What would you do if you was in Solon's place? What was the first thing you would start looking at? As a category of things that we have passing every day in Congress, it seems. Got to start addressing unjust laws. If you will recall, I mentioned it, you probably won't, because I get the most out of my sermons. Frederick Bastiat, The Law, in the French Revolution, and this is available if you want it again, I can send you a file. He made the point that when people get into power, they make laws for their own benefit, not the laws for the whole society, but favouring themselves. So we have 100,000 pages in Congress on the IRS tax code laws, with specific loopholes for specific people at specific times, depending whether it's a Democrat or a Republican in office. So we have to address laws. So what did he do? Number one, he reformed and abandoned the law and abolished enslavement for debt. Number two, he freed the enslaved. Number three, he extended the right to vote. We call it suffrage. Remember how long ladies in this country had to do without suffrage, the right to express their opinion and voting? Number four, he reformed the currency. What do we need to reform the currency? What are we doing to our currency right now? Inflation is theft. Devaluing, it's watering down. It's like getting a bottle of wine, pouring half of it into another one, and filling up the both bottles with water. You've watered down the worth and the quality and value of the wine. And that's exactly what happens to currency as well. Why are people flocking to gold and to silver and to platinum now? Because of that very self-same reason. By the way, it's a long time to buy gold. If you hadn't bought it a long time ago, forget it. It's much, much too expensive now. So, we'll carry on. So they had a circulation of new circulation of coinage. Then he regulated weights and measures. So he's got the weights and measure system, he's got the coinage. For what purpose? So that there was equity, so that there was certainty, so that trade would be encouraged. Okay. Then he finally, number six, established legal codes governing the inheritance, property, civil rights of citizens, penalties for crimes, and then he did something very unusual. He went to the Athenian council and he said to them, I'll put it in my own words because he was probably very eloquent. He said, I know you lot. In fact, there is a biblical reference which I'll give you which will support this. It's in the book of Nehemiah. He said, you lot have to agree to these, otherwise I'm going to resign. And not only must you agree to them, you must take a vow, an oath, a written oath that you will not change them. You go to the book of Nehemiah at the end, you'll see similar circumstances. People were oppressing their brothers and sisters with high interest rates. Nehemiah said, you should not be doing this. And he had them publicly swear an oath in front of witnesses that they would not do this again. And so subsequently, maybe Solon knew about this, I don't know. But Solon had the Athenian council swear and take an oath that they would maintain his reforms for 10 years. Stability. Certitude. Now let me ask you, what do you think happened next? Any ideas? No ideas? Alright. What do you think would have happened over a period of 10 years? Raise taxes? Harry, you were going to make a point? Anyone else? The middle class would have developed. What happens in our society? Well, we're constant welfare. All right, people get poor. People would petition to change laws. We'd have a mini of the IRS, 100,000 plus pages of this and that, and they would continually petition to change what they had promised and sworn that they would not change. So Solon, being a wise man that he was, said, okay, I have your oath. And then he bought himself a ship, and on the premise of going out to see the rest of the world, went away for 10 years, because legally on the books it was they could not change any of these laws without his permission. He knew that by staying there, constant petitions would come to him and arguments would be made and this and that, and the grinding down, the war of attrition, wearing out the principle of what they had agreed to. And he was one of the wisest men, and so for 10 years Greece had stability and had to maintain their laws. So you see, there are some people who are very wise, and Solon was one of them. It would be really great if we could do that with our House and Senate and President, but we can't. By leaving, he knew that he could not be ground down. And so we'll go to our current third historical example today, the United States and Europe. If you're aware of the world news today, and Scott was talking about this in his sermonette, the euro is on the brink of collapse. Germany is the only one that's going to hold Europe together. And will maintain the strength of the euro. Why would Germany be the only one to hold Europe together? Meditate on that while I make a couple of points here. Europe is suffering from socialism. Socialism in Greece, in Italy, in Ireland, in Spain, and in Portugal basically runs the same way as socialism is running in the United States today. It runs the same way as President Obama wants to, and presumably Democrats, want to get it to run in America today. Now, it's only partially running that way. LBJ back, Lyndon Baines Johnson, the Prime Minister, or the President back then, spent, I don't know how many, uncounted millions on the Great Society, throwing money at America's poor. Okay? Gradually things have been put in, and more and more and more things have been added. And we now have a huge social network system in America. Okay. In Europe, you can work about a 40-hour week or 35-hour week. Several weeks holiday, vacation a year, high pensions when you retire at 50 or 55, healthcare and benefits taken care of for the rest of your life.
Okay? It's pretty good. The only problem is, and America is facing exactly the same thing economically. As time goes on, the number of people that are being born, the number of people in your country that are working enough to make enough money to support that healthcare system, all of those pensions, all of those few hours work a week, all of those vacations, diminish. And in Greece, you have the victimizers, that is, the Parliament of Greece, who are claiming they're being victimized by the victims. They're having riots there, and they're saying, you can't take away these benefits. We earned them. What happened with the, what do they call them? I'll call it a rebellion that started in, was it New York? What do they call it? Occupy America. You know, Occupy Wall Street, thank you. And what happened right there? People were complaining. You can't take away this stuff forever. We've got a right to that. You know, I made a point. If a man doesn't work, he doesn't eat. What happened to that principle? What happened to that principle? You can't have low work hours, high wages and pensions without eventually the system crumbling under the problem. As Margaret Thatcher said, socialism works very well until you run out of spending other people's money. How true. Socialism, if you write down a quote, write down that one. Socialism works very well until you run out of other people's money. And other people's money in Portugal, in Italy, in Ireland, in Spain, and in Greece, and in England is running out. England has a huge illegal immigration problem, has a high social welfare system, and I heard an incredible statement by Ben Stein on the radio when he was doing Rush Limbaugh show the other day. He said, for a nation of approximately 50 million people, the national health program employs the third largest number of people in the whole world. Only before it is China in their army, and I missed the second one. But England's national health system is the third in line in the whole world of size of employment. It's unbelievable. Do you know if you want a hip implant, a hip replacement in England, you may have to wait 2 or 3 years. But if you want to pay cash for it, you can have it done tomorrow. That's after 70 years of socialism. So you can guess, socialism began in the welfare system when I was a child, when I was born, about 1941. Mind you, things were very, very bad at that time. Welfare. What is welfare? Unemployment is a characteristic unique to the human species only. I never thought about that before. This came from a book called The Path by Laurie Beth Jones. And she goes on to say, all other creatures and creations seem to know what they're supposed to be doing. My corollary to that is, humans are the only ones who give out welfare to those who can but don't work. Approximately 50% of the nation is on some form of government handout, money taken from others who are working and paying taxes. We have a lot of false information going around on our public media today about who does what, who pays how much in taxes. I remember years ago that Julius Nyerere was speaking publicly. And he said about America, he said, when are you talk about welfare in America? You're talking about someone who has a house, who has a car, who has a television, and a refrigerator and food in their home. When I talk about welfare, I'm talking about where's the next meal coming from. That's what poor is. Today, people are taking $30,000 and $40,000 a home on welfare. Have one or two cars, have multiple coloured televisions, and are living off the fat of the land. How long will it be before we become like Greece? Those aren't, shallow words. It's only a question of time. The US government has, by the way, $16 trillion in debt. 15 was close, but what's a trillion? You know, neither here nor there. And fundamentally, the problem has been overspending and breaking of the principle. Too much regulation on businesses, and as a result, too much taxing. This is not a political statement, it's just from a point of view of party politics. It is a statement of truth. Both Democrats and Republicans are equally to blame for our system of Social Security. They have for years put IOUs in the National Treasury and taken it out the other side. For years. And demographically, we are coming to the point where the number of people, this is the way it will work, the number of people here supporting the number of people here is going like this. The number of people here, the baby boomers, go way up, and the people who are now earning and paying Social Security, whereas it would be one person to one, let's say when Frederick D. Roosevelt established Social Security, now it's going to be about five or six or seven for one pensioner. It ain't going to work over time. Now, thankfully, I'll be dead by the time that comes along, if the system lasts that long. But that's kind of selfish in attitude, isn't it? The problem is a long, long, long-term problem. And it's a problem of never, ever living within our means. Never living the way God intended us to do. And that is, we work, we labour, we save, we're diligent, we care for ourselves, and we do not have a handout except from within families or in a little local community. Families in my day as young took care of families. And they had hard times, you'd take them in and you'd help them out. But they'd better get out there and be chasing a job very, very quickly. And they better support themselves and so forth. Now, if someone was injured, that was just tough. You know, we came from coal mining families. And, back then you got in the coal mines, there wasn't Social Security, there wasn't welfare. You had the operation, your arm was gone, your leg was gone, you got black lung or pneumonia silicosis, where the silica from breathing in the coal dust all the time clogged up your lungs. And you had walking around England, which I saw regularly, was the whistlers. The whistlers were the old men again. Because they could only just get enough air in to move. And they wouldn't walk very far. Tough. Maybe they shouldn't have gone in the coal mines in the first place. Tough. That's all there was. Well, maybe we should have had pit head showers and breathing apparatus. Weren't invented. They didn't care. The raw side of capitalism is terrible. Evil. The raw side of socialism is terrible. And evil. And we need a balance in between in a God's economic system, whereby you have the appropriate support of family and local community, along with enough encouragement to say, you must get out there and do something. You must get out there and work. To sit at home and be unemployed for 99 weeks, which is what currently is on the books. And this, what did they call that law they just passed for another 2 months? Tax reduction extension. It was an increase of benefits for being unemployed. It wasn't a tax extension increase. They put all these fancy names on there, and they're basically lying or misrepresenting. So we need both in God's system. Let's have a look at the biblical principles. Debt is usually bad. Now, I say usually bad because it doesn't always have to be bad. I say usually bad. You can't get into debt if you don't have credit. The way you got credit when I was a child, as I remember my parents after World War One, wanting to buy a new bed. So what they did was they went down to the shops and put a small amount of money deposit on a bed. It was called the Never Never. That's what they called it. In other words, you may never, never pay it off, or it would take a long time to pay it off. And so my mother would go down there every week and put a shilling or two if she could afford it. I remember my mother just with a couple of coppers, 1/12 of a shilling in her purse, and nothing more coming in for 2 or 3 more days. We were very, very poor, and it was a blessing. You'll say why? I'll tell you later. But typically you couldn't get what we call credit today, and as Barry pulled out, I've got it with me, my driving license, I also had that, my credit card in there, and I can put $15,000 on that. It's obscene. It's insane. It's a sin to me to pay one penny of interest. I paid it once in Pasadena about 25 years ago when my bill didn't come to me, and I was, you know, busy and I hadn't taken notice, and then I got the next bill. Wow, wait a minute. I about croaked. Why? Because it's just obscene that you don't pay off and you're on a revolving account 19, 20, 21% interest per annum. Oh, you only need to make 25 cents or $25 on this bill. Look out, it's going to kill you. So I have not paid interest but once in 30 years in America, and I don't intend to pay interest ever again in my life on such a thing as a credit card. So tea is a medium, it's fine. Never had those things. Carte Blanche, I think, was the first one that came out in America, and it literally was cardboard. Diners Club was another one that came out, which was literally cardboard. Very easy to be fraudulently made, but nobody seemed to do that. And then eventually the snowball got into rolling down the hill, and everybody today is in debt. Well, I've got it written down here somewhere. I've got a whole bunch of miscellaneous notes here. Let's see. Well, I can't see it, so it can't be important. But the snowball now is running downhill for people who are foolish enough to get into debt. Why is it debt usually bad? Well, the reason is because it exposes you to danger. It exposes you to danger. For example, Psalm 15, if you'll turn to there, please. Psalm 15. Says that we should be as godly people a certain way. And I just want to read part C of Psalm 15, which is the after the Lord. He who swears to his own hurt and changes not. So, my friend Barry Bettis here has a very nice lawnmower, and he lives near me. So I go knock on his door and say, Brian Bettis. Got to get it right in a minute. Brian, I'd like to borrow your lawnmower. Can I borrow it from you? Your lawnmower. Would you say yes? Play along with me. It's a good lawnmower. It's beautiful. It's new. Would you lend it to me? Would there be any conditions? Okay, what do those conditions be? You break it, you fix it. That's fair enough. Okay? So I take his lawnmower out, and I'm going through a rocky part, and I hit a huge rock, and the blade breaks off, the motor is done. I agree to return this in good working order. You break it, you fix it. Oh my, what's it going to cost me? $250, let's say, to fix this motor. Borrowing, and he was quite correct with his conditions. I said this to my brother who was here recently. You can use my our Lincoln Town Car, but if you smash it up, you pay for it. Okay. And I would have made him pay for it too. This is getting it in whole and working. Hey, you smash it up, you pay for it, mate. Fine. Same when I would drive his car. But the bottom line is, you have a responsibility. You have exposed yourself to danger. That is the danger of breaking what you have borrowed. So borrowing is not necessarily a good thing. Let me see. Have we forgotten something? Have we forgotten something? I've got it later here, so I'll get to it in a moment. Okay, what else is wrong with getting into debt? What is it a lack of? Has to do with you. Self? Self-control, another word. Self-discipline, denying yourself. Don't do that, you'll hurt your psyche. Not a good thing. Not a good thing. It's a lack of self-discipline. And as Shakespeare said, I think I can do it from memory, I did have a friend. And surely, as they follow earth, to their own self be true, and surely as day follows night, then you cannot be forced to anyone. See, there's a crystallizing truth in what Shakespeare wrote in the 16th century in Hamlet about borrowing. Don't borrow, don't lend. We're still friends. I'd borrow his lawnmower, go back to him and say, sorry, broke it. Well, fix it. I can't. Sorry, I haven't got the money. Whoops, we have a problem. I've exposed myself to danger. I'm going to lose my friend over this. Neither borrower nor lender be. It's a lack of self-discipline. Now, the other side of that coin is there is such a thing called a productive debt. Anyone like to speculate what a productive debt might be? I bet some of us have got one. Mortgage and buying a house is a productive debt. Anyone come up with another productive debt? Business. Sometimes you need to buy capital for business if you've got a going concern. Anyone come up with another productive debt? Cars? My wife said cars? Education. By the way, where is it? I've got so much stuff here, I'm so far as following. In here, there is an article of Dealing with Debt by Aaron Dean, and gives very, very good information about going to school. Okay? Going to college. If you're going to go to college, get an education. If anyone wants it, you're welcome to it. I don't know why they send it to me, but they do, and I pass it on, so it's there if you want it afterwards. Yes, exactly. These would be things that are appropriate to getting a certain amount of debt. So, do you want to go to MIT? Let's say you're really intelligent. At $60,000 a year? $24,000 at the end of 4 years for a bachelor's? You better earn a lot of money, plus interest. As the financial aid officer for 15 years, I can tell you that what Mr. Armstrong established was really wonderful in a way. He would allow you to work off part of your bill, sometimes, if not all of it, if you worked in the summer. He kept the tuition rates low. Now, that was a blessing he could pass on, but there was a benefit in that blessing because it reinvested, in that sense, in the population of the church. In the early 30s and into the 40s, the people who were coming to the church were very poor and uneducated. So he saw the need to have the education, and I invested in my education thanks to the largesse of the church at the time, and finally came out with a bachelor's and then went on after that for a postgraduate degree. But I was able to pay off my debt, and I worked like a dog, 20 hours a week every week. In the summer I worked all summer. One summer I worked in a scrap iron yard because it was an easy job to get, and I was throwing this stuff in a guillotine and chopping it up and filling up this bin and making as much money as I could so I could go back to school. When I came to America, when I was a financial aid officer in Pasadena, and I started looking at the books, and I started seeing the debts some of these kids were building up, and I'd call them in and sit them down and say, you know, what did you do this summer? I went home and had a good time. And said, did you work? Well, I worked a bit. How much did you work? Oh, maybe a couple of weeks or so. But what about this bill? What are you going to do with it? Well, I thought I might pay it off next summer. Parsimonious Arthur. You lost opportunity here to work in the summer. You didn't take advantage of the gift that college was giving you by letting you increase a debt. So I'm going to have to say you've got two choices. Number one, you go talk to your parents, aunts and uncles, or whoever you want to see if they will help you. And number two is drop out for a semester and do go and work. Oh, the tears. You'd have thought I was Genghis Khan. I had one young man called Scott. Big guy. Very nice personality. Sat in front of my desk. And I basically went through the scenario with him. And he... What? I've got to leave? I said, afraid so. I mean, you know, you're at a place where you frankly cannot pay off the debt, even if you work for a year, simply because the previous financial aid officer hadn't been as hard-hearted as this one, and had let him slip by. So he left. Some years later, he wrote me a letter. He said, "Dear Mr. Sapling, thank you so very, very much indeed for saying no to me. You are the first one that ever told me no in my life." I'm saying, boy, what went wrong in your life? What went wrong? Didn't your parents teach you? Obviously not. He was a spoilt young man. Didn't have a sense of self-responsibility, didn't have a sense of honour about the debt he had, and thought he could just part it up. And then he went on to say, "Thanks to you now, I have paid off my debt, I am married and have a young son." Aha, the bell rang in his head. You can't do these things, or you can do them in society, but eventually you end up in a terrible place if you do not take care of them. So a productive debt is when you do something like purchasing a home. Maybe there might be a reason to borrow a little bit for an old clunker so you can get back to forth to work if you need that. You need to buy some equipment for your business, as has already been mentioned. Maybe you can go to a college or community college which will give you get a degree for a quarter of what you'd pay at MIT or Harvard or whatever. And let me tell you, young people sitting here, you don't need to go to a big school to get a big degree. As an employer, I can assure you, they want to know that you've gone through the hoops and have learned. If you have a good vocabulary, if you can write and you can do math, everything else you can learn, whether it be history or whatever. And then after you've got out of a bachelor's program, people are looking for people with character and self-discipline who are willing to work hard. And if you've got a community college degree, that will suffice them. Thank you very much indeed. You can always go to school and get more. That is economic sense in an economically insensible society at this time. An unproductive debt is taking a girl out to a very expensive restaurant because she's nice and you like her. Don't do that. It is going on a vacation and you haven't got the money to pay for it. Don't do that. It is a cruise ship that you put on a credit card. Don't do that. It is doing fun stuff. Buying cars when you can't afford to it. And there was one young lady I can think of down in the Waco area where Brian came from. And she had this beautiful car. I mean, it probably cost her 16 grand, but didn't have a job. You know, relationships, we are attracted to each other. But we don't find out the reality of that person until we may be married. One guy I know married a young lady, very nice, all happy, and then he found out she had $30,000 in debt. Well, why didn't you find out that before you started? That's pretty bad. 30 grand. The only time I've had a debt that big is when I had a mortgage on a house. And my wife and I, being the wise people that we were, thank God, not that I'm particularly smart, sat down before we got married. How much money have you got? This is how much I owe. Put that together. Have you got it yet? No. Have I got it yet? No. I've got all my furniture. She's got her furniture. Okay. This is what we're earning. What shall we do? And then we went on a financial plan. And then because both of us were working, we didn't take fancy vacations, we didn't live in big houses, we paid $250 a month for a freeway house in Pasadena, which was two bedrooms, which leaked in the corner of the garage. Okay? And we saved, and we had tax-deferred annuities set up, we lived in a low lifestyle, we worked hard, and as I said, we didn't take fancy vacations. We lived nicely. We brought our two boys up and to teach them economic responsibility in seeing this. And today we are totally debt-free. We have no debts. We own our home, we own our vehicles, and we have investments. 30 years of solid, conservative dedication to be where we are today. I was 42 when I got married. Before that, I was in La La Land. I was doing my job, I had my wife and I had my kids, and I was driving all over the country. I travelled to Australia, drove all over Australia, doing the work, and not even thinking about these more long-term issues. I got to 40, my wife died, and whoa, I've got two kids here, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? So I took out insurance against their life. And I began to wise up, and when my wife came along, she was very wise, and we put a plan of attack together, and 30 years later, here we are. 30 years. Start when you are young. Plan. Go ahead, step by step. You can still enjoy yourself. You can still enjoy nice clothes. You just don't have to go mad. Be conservative in your approach. And you might want to buy a fancy car. A car is a tool. It gets you from point A to point B. And you want a car that will get you from point A to point B safely. You don't want a car that's going to break down every 5 minutes, but you don't need a Rolls Royce or a Lamborghini Countach or a Porsche or anything like that. Okay? It's just not practical. Now, if you get to the point where you've earned a tremendous amount of money and you want to go out and buy a Rolls Royce, and you could do it because the money's in the bank, fine, wonderful, shut out $150,000 to $200,000, fine, go for it, I don't care if you've got the money. If you don't have the money, neither borrow it nor lend a bit. Don't borrow it, it'll kill you. Alright, really, we are living in society and in much of our world in a state of the denial of reality. The US House of Representatives have not taken care of a long-term known problem. I should say our governments and our presidents have not. We're spending more than we earn. It's been a constant problem. Reality is denied in Europe. Italy, Ireland, Portugal, Spain, France, Greece. People on welfare are denying reality. They're lazy. In all too many cases. And as with the Wall Street, Occupying Wall Street group, one of the newsmen was saying, you know, it's the first time I've seen anyone who's on welfare protesting about closing down Wall Street, wearing designer clothes and using iPhones. Think about it. Think about it. They don't know what poverty is. Roberto Benigni was in the movie It's a Beautiful World, and it won an Oscar. He was, you know, awarded an Oscar. He got up on the platform, and in his broken Italian speech, he said, I want to thank my parents for the gift of poverty. And you ought to have heard that audience go, what? You're crazy. Very sensible man. If you've been poor, you know what it means to be poor. If you've always grown up out of touch with reality, never having worked, and having everything provided for you, you don't know what work is. You don't know how to survive. And when you do get money, and when you do make success, you value that. That's great. That's wonderful. And you treasure it. Because you've got sweat equity. You've got character. You've got self-discipline in the equation. And that's so important in economics. We have redefined what is poor. Today, I see a car, or a house, or colour TVs, or freezers, or refrigerators, and that is not being poor. That's what we create poor today with welfare. We see, unfortunately, laws of our land encourage illegitimacy by giving more money to young ladies who have babies. The more babies you have, the more money you get. That's the way it used to be, and that is a sin. Two things happened when a young lady got pregnant in my day. The brothers turned up around there with the father, got this young man by the scruff of the neck and held his nose to nose. You're going to marry this young lady, and you better take care of her, or we'll be around there. And there was no messing about. You would have been beaten to within a hair of your life by that family if you didn't take care of their kid and their grandchild. Now you say, but that's cruel. Maybe we better look at what took place first. Maybe we better consider the male as the aggressor, the responsibility of that action. Maybe we better think about that. And now we have a life being brought into the world as a result of that action. An abortion. Illegitimacy and the stain that used to come with illegitimacy. So you had two choices. You had a shotgun wedding, or you were taken care of. I wonder which is most just. Laziness and slothfulness comes as a result of being supported when you can work. And it's always good to get hungry and to know what hunger means. And that will drive you to work. Problem is, we've taken these social, normal, godly restraints off of by a wrong philosophy. The reality is that you've got to get a job, any job, anything. You want to sweep roads? You want to clean toilets? You want to mop out oil at the bottom of ships? You want to dig holes in the road? You want to wash dishes? You want to paint? I've done all those. There's no job I'm not willing to do, or probably, in that sense, low enough that I haven't done it. I know I can get out at 70 years old and get work if I wanted it. I have now developed some skills that have nothing to do with theology or church, which I could get a job, and in fact, from time to time, I do get jobs. The point is, when you're hungry, you're willing to work. If somebody doesn't say, well, here, have some food. Oh, that's okay, I don't really need to go out. And they stay home and they don't work. Your full-time job should be looking for a job. Period. If you're wise, you will save your money. You will live on a cash basis, you will live within your means, and you will tithe faithfully. Finally, attitudes. I've shown you the secular examples and what unsound economic systems provide. And now let's briefly look at what attitudes towards economic systems will bring. Today is a living example in our country of unsound economic systems. The fundamental motive may be to collapse the system, as I said before, to prove that capitalism, which is harsh, does not work, and institute a European economic socialist system. It's already proven not to work, and it separates people, as I mentioned about the attitude in Europe, demanding to be supported by their pensions and their retirements and so forth, and eventually that overtaking and destroying the system. Why would anyone like President Obama and healthcare be instituted knowing the debt? Takes away, number one, personal responsibility. Takes away, number two, power, the ability for you to do for yourself, which you should do. Takes away, number three, your freedom. Three very important factors. Three very important factors. And when you have your freedom taken away, you have more and more regulation which comes down on top of you, and you have more and more conditions. I signed up for Kaiser Permanente. 26 different items were sent to me. Now, you want a book that big? That was one of the items. You have a formulary, which is drugs, there's another one. This is the doctors that you cover, there's another one. And on and on and on you go with the stuff you've got to try and read and understand about Kaiser Permanente just to get coverage, because the Medicare is getting to be poor and they say, we want you to move over to Kaiser Permanente, which is a health maintenance organisation. And what happens then? More rules, more regulations. Oh no, you can't have this drug. No, you can't go to that doctor. No, you can't go to this dentist. No, you can't go to that optician. And on and on and on it goes. Brethren, this is not a party political speech. You don't want to go there. Believe me, you don't want to go there. God's system is based on freedom. It is based on responsibility. It is based on reality. It is based on character. Let me read you something and ask you if this applies to today, or if this is today. The budget should be balanced, the treasury should be refilled, public debt should be reduced, the arrogance of officialdom should be tempered and controlled, and the insistence of foreign lands should be curtailed, lest we become bankrupt. People must again learn to work instead of living on public assistance. Do you all agree with that? Anyone disagree with that? Do you know who wrote that? Cicero, 55 BC. What have we learned in 2,064 years? Exactly where we're going today. Exactly where we're going today. Now, why? The reason is because we have encouraged ignorance in our education systems. You frowned. We have. That's a reality. Our history books have been rewritten, which don't reflect really the history. We have eroded the principles, if you can erode a principle, you really can't, you can only break them or keep them, and values in our constitution of our founding fathers, who understood what Cicero wrote in 55 BC. So, where are we today? Winston Churchill said, the longer you look back in history, the further you can look forward. I deliberately gave you a lot of history leading up to this. It doesn't work the way it has been done time after time after time in the past. And this country that I have adopted and allowed me to come is doing the same thing. I came here in 1980 when President Reagan, and I wasn't aware of the politics at the time, I was only going to be here for a year and all the rest of it, and here I am 30 years later, and I'm looking back and I realise now, wow, yeah, I can remember 11.5%, 12% on mortgages. I was happy as Larry when I got it down to 8.5%. But I didn't realise what was going on. Now I understand, because I'm in this country, and the more I look back, the more you can see what is going to take place in the future, as Winston Churchill said. God's system must be based in freedom of choice. God's system is based in reality. If you don't have a dollar, don't spend it. God's system is based in character and self-discipline, whether it's weights and measures or whatever. We have God's word. Prophecy is marching on. Exactly where are we? I don't know, but I can tell you what. We're a lot closer to end times than we were 50 years ago. A lot closer. Two scriptures. 1 Timothy chapter 6. This has to do with attitude. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verses 6 through 11. With godliness, with contentment is great gain. We brought nothing into the world, and it's certain we can carry nothing out. How true that is. The last several years of dealing with my mother in the assisted living, and how many elderly people I've seen who've been very well in the past end up going out of this life the same way as they came in, needing the care of a baby. Money, clothing, food, materialism, doesn't matter anymore, and you can be happy to die, and many of them are. Come into the world with nothing and you leave it. We carry nothing out except for the character, the knowledge and self-discipline that we have. For verse 8, having food and raiment, food and clothing, with these we should be content, but we don't have to be complacent. But to those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Don't love money. Enjoy it if you've got it, but don't love it, lust after it. You're breaking the 11th commandment. For which some have strayed from the path for faith in their greediness. You see, greed is a terrible thing. Greediness, and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. Verse 17. Command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty or high-minded or vain or arrogant, nor trust in uncertain riches. Why are they uncertain? Because they can be gone tomorrow. You got investments in the stock market and the bottom drops out. Boom! It's gone like that. If that's your security, forget it. Don't trust in uncertain riches, but in a living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. Let them do good work, that they be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share. Read Viktor Frankl and the Man's Search for Meaning. Those who survived the concentration camps were willing to give to others their last piece of bread. They were the ones that survived, not those who ate and took the bread. See, brethren, God can provide for you. Let them do good works, willing to share, verse 19, storing up for themselves a good foundation for the time to come, that they may hold on eternal life. And finally here, and I'm sorry I'm over time, I don't normally go this long, Luke chapter 12, verses 13 and 15. Luke 12, 13 and 15. And one of the people from the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or an arbitrator over you?" He said to them, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses." The attitude we should have towards money is it's a tool to be used appropriately. It is to be treasured and taken care of. It is not to be depended in. And the world basically gives us no guarantee. We are in huge, beyond our imagination, beyond our means of helping at all, this huge economic crisis that is bewildering the Western world. We have no way of managing that, no way of doing anything about it. The only salvation and the final analysis is God. So, Do your best. Depend on God for the rest. Live your life wisely with self-discipline and trust in God.